Presenter, and you heard Avra give a little hat tip out to Heidi. It's Heidi Hartman, and she is the president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the needs for women-centered, policy-oriented research. If you're ever looking for a number on the economy and women, just go to their website, and they have them all. More than you'd need. A research professor at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., Dr. Hartman's research focuses on women in the economy, employment, pay equity, and retirement security. She's published numerous articles in journals and books, and her work has been translated into more than a dozen languages. She lectures internationally and frequently testifies before Congress. Dr. Hartman has a Ph.D. in economics from Yale. In 1994, this is my favorite part, she received the MacArthur Fellowship Award, commonly known as the Genius Award, for her work in the field of women in economics. So, everyone, warm welcome for Ms. Heidi Hartman.
Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I was taking a look at our program book, and I discovered that even though this convention center is huge, you are more than filling it up, and you are also having sessions in all the hotels in town. And I can't believe there are so many people here, so thank you for coming to our session. I want to say a little bit about IWPR, and just point out that we handed out a number of handouts for you, fact sheets and things in our newsletter, the kind of stuff we produce in large numbers, and there should be some extras lying there. In the back table. Health is one of our areas, and we have done a number of studies on access to health care for women, on paid sick days, which I'll talk about today, on breastfeeding, example, that's a new issue we're getting into, domestic violence in the past, and we hope to do again. So a lot of different areas where our work intersects with yours. I hope you know about our institute. I hope you'll use our website. If you want to see the website, it's right there, IWPR.org. And if you have trouble remembering the numbers, the order that the letters are in, just think iWiper. Okay, that's sometimes how I remember it when I'm in a hurry. Okay, and no relationships to disclose. Okay, that's required that we put that on there. Financial relationships, you know, the drug companies are not paying me to say anything today. I have three parts to the talk. The first part is a brief overview of women in the labor market. I think I won't be overlapping too much with what Avra and Marcia have already so eloquently talked about. But this shows you how many women and men are participating in the labor force, a percentage of them over time, and it's designed to give you a sense of the long-term time trend. This is the first part of the talk on the labor market, then I'm going to be talking about paid sick days and then about Social Security. And I have some learning objectives for those of you in the CEU program, so that's why we're doing this right now. What this shows is that over time, women's labor force participation has risen tremendously, and men's has fallen somewhat. And most of the falling for men is really due to wealth. We're a richer society, men can spend more time in school, they can retire earlier. Some people are left out of the labor market, but in fact, that hasn't really been increasing over time. This is really primarily a wealth effect. For women, the increase in labor force participation is primarily an education effect. The more education you get, the more you want to work. And that tends to outweigh the fact that your own and men's incomes are going up. The more income you have, the less you should be working. But the pull to work is also great. And if women's wages go up, you know, they can't make much staying at home, so they tend to want to go to work. The higher the wage, the more likely they are to go to work. But you can also see in the last 10 years, plateau. As a labor economist, I think that's horrible, and I think we should be doing something about it, and I think things like paid family leave, more subsidized child care, more job guarantee after you've been absent for family reasons, all of that would help us see that labor force participation rate of women go up. This is just showing that men's and women's wages are converging slowly in the United States, still have a big wage gap, as Marcia discussed, but look at that red line for women, wham, wham, wham. Way up. And last 10 years, plateau. This shows the different annual earnings of white men, Asian American men, black men, Hispanic men, white women, Asian American women, black women, Hispanic women. And basically, white and Asian American men earn the most, Hispanic women earn the least. And an interesting new fact in the last few years is that Asian American women are earning the most among all women, $42,331 a year, and white women, $38,533 a year. This was in 2009. The brand new 2010 data have just come out. I haven't checked it out yet. What is that about? Jared Bernstein, most recently economic advisor to Vice President Biden, now at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, said, I looked into that. That is because Asian American women do not go into school teaching as much as white women do. If they did, their wages would be just as low as white women's. So they have a comparable education to white women, but they're not going into an area which where you don't get paid as much as you should for your qualifications. These are some of the public policies that have increased women's employment opportunities. Marcia spoke about the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which helped us get back to where we needed to be in terms of employment discrimination. I'll just mention the right to unionize in 1935, the right to the minimum wage in 1938, the Equal Pay Act for work in the same jobs in 1963, the 1964 Civil Rights Act with Title VII on employment, which included sex from the very beginning. I can't tell you how many people say to me, sex wasn't included in the 1964 Civil Rights Act until 1972. And I'm like, I wonder what they're thinking of. I don't know. 1967, the executive orders that require federal contractors not to discriminate. These were very, very important. And in the late 60s and 70s, we had hearings all over the United States at universities all over the United States saying, you're a federal contractor. Why are you discriminating against women? And that was very important to getting women into universities and into employment. 1972, Title IX of the Education Amendments, another huge reason that universities had to open up things like law schools and medical schools to women. They were virtually closed to women before the 60s and 70s. The 1978 Pregnancy Discrimination Act, very important. Doesn't really give you a right to anything, except that if your employer is already giving men something, men who have a heart attack or a car accident, they have to give you the same thing for pregnancy and childbirth. Before that, they could just say, sorry, I'm not covering pregnancy and childbirth in my health insurance. I'm not giving you sick leave for that. Who cares if I give it for heart attacks and car accidents? And what the typical thing that happened when a woman got pregnant was she quit her job because she didn't want to wait around to be fired. That was the pregnancy leave we had, was quitting your job. I'm not kidding. This is what it was in the workforce that I grew up in. This was passed in 1978. That's not so very long ago. And the 1993 Family Medical Leave Act, which does guarantee you, this does give you a right, this guarantees you your job, even if you had an absence related to your own illness or family care. If you work for a large enough employer of 50 or more workers, you can be out 12 weeks and still have your job guaranteed. So that's a very important right. Even though it's unpaid, it's a particularly important right to poor women who really need their jobs. And it's very hard to go find a new job after you've just had a baby or just had a major illness. So these are some of the laws you're supposed to be knowing about in your CEU. You got that? Yep, we did that learning objective. Okay, moving on. I wanted to comment about marriage and the relationship to marriage and poverty, because some of the policies that we have to help women are really only available to married women, and I'm going to get into that in the third part of the talk about Social Security. But take a look at this. In the poorest families, those with less than $27,000 in income, fewer than half of people are married. These are only families, so these are not individuals. These are either mothers with children, two sisters living together, a husband and wife, and a grandmother, whatever. People who are related to each other living in households. So the married couple families are in red, and they are less than half of those with low incomes. They're a large share of those with middle incomes, from $27,000 to $112,000, more than three quarters. And they're the highest share of families with over $112,000 a year, the top fifth of all families. 93% of those families are married. So this sort of shows that marriage increasingly is kind of becoming less common among low-income people and the poor, and much more common among the wealthy. And there's a lot of public policy implications of that, which we should in fact be paying more attention to. My second part of my talk is about paid sick days, and I'm sure as public health people you realize that having paid sick days would really help us, because it would reduce contagion, it would allow people to get preventive care, and it would reduce emergency room use. And all of these things are things that IWPR, Institute for Women's Policy Research, has done research on. This shows you who doesn't have access to paid sick days: Latinas, Among women, Latinas are the most who don't have it. 54% of all Latinas do not have access to a single paid sick day. And it's about 40% for white women and black women, and it's about 34% for Asian American women. They are better covered with paid sick days. This is just discussing the fact that if you have paid sick days, you spread disease less. We did a little study of public workers and private sector workers, and public workers have more paid sick days. So when the flu came in, you could see how many people were taking off paid sick days. And of course, in the early part, public sick days, public workers took off more paid sick days. But over the whole course of the H1N1, they took off fewer because they reduced contagion by staying home. In the private sector, fewer took off sick days in the beginning. But at the end, when we added it all up, they took off a lot more sick days. So we really do know it reduces contagion in the workplace. It helps you get preventive care, especially for your kids. You need to do that during the day. You need time off from work to do that. And we have a new estimate of how much it reduces emergency room use in the U.S. It saves $1 billion. If every worker in the U.S. had access to paid sick days, we would save $1 billion in emergency room department use. And we just recently calculated this, and we consulted with HHS to make sure we got it right. And we haven't released the full report yet, but it will be out very soon. Check out our website. And half of that $1 billion, by the way, is being spent by Medicaid, Medicare, and other public health programs. So we would also save $500 million for the taxpayer right off the bat. I wanted to give you a summary of what's been happening to women in the recession. This is actually about the number of jobs that men and women have on payrolls. And the dark line at the very bottom shows you the official length of the recession. And you can see that employment for both men and women continued to drop after the recession officially ended. The blue is men's recession when their employment was dropping. The pink is women's recession when their employment was still dropping. And you get to that point right where the blue and pink happen to, where it moves from purple to pink. That was when there was an equality in the number of women and men on payrolls. And I hope you remember that. There was a media frenzy. Women and men equal on payrolls in the United States. And I'm like, for 20, 30 years, we've been 47.5% of the workforce. Why do we really care that because the recession laid off more men than women, we're finally at 50%? And it's also, it was only 50% if you ignored about 10% of the labor force that aren't on this graph, people who work as independent contractors and so forth and don't work on payrolls, agriculture, mining, the military, they're not on here. So it wasn't really equal anyway. But since then, we've had recovery for men, very slow, but slightly up. No recovery at all for women, flat, flat, flat. So women are not participating in this economic recovery yet. We did some new survey data. This is also on our website. It shows that women are suffering more as a result of the recession and the recovery. The red is women, the blue is men. Many more women than men say they can't afford health care, can't pay their monthly utility bills, can't pay for transportation, and even 20% of women saying they're having trouble paying for food now, today, in America. These are the percentage worried about not having enough to retire on, and again, more women than men, and you can see the big increases for both women and men as a result of the recession from 2007 to 2010. This is all survey research, so I'm just going to flip through here because I've gotten the high sign. And basic facts about Social Security, we spend about $700 billion a year, and it goes to 53 million people. You can see it goes to a lot of retired people, that's the most, then disabled, and then survivors, people in families that were dependent on the worker who died. They don't have any retirement of their own, but they're getting that retirement. And it helps 4 million children a year, 21 million men, 27 million women. So it is disproportionately a women's program. And this is why I think the politicians are really out to cut it. So we have to keep them from cutting it. It's one of the things I spend a lot of time on. What you can see is how important Social Security is for women as an asset in retirement. It's as a part of their income, it's gone up over this whole 20-year period. Earnings has gone up, people are working more. Savings is way down because of the recession. Pensions is about equal for women. But for men, you can see pensions has shrunk as a result of the recession, assets has shrunk, earnings is up for men, Social Security is up for men. So more and more people are depending on Social Security because of what's been going on in the bigger economy in that crisis. Okay, that's a little complicated, so I'm going to skip that. This just talks about some of the pluses for Social Security. Everybody gets it, and you it provides benefits to wives and former wives, whether you ever worked or not. If you were a homemaker, but you were married for at least 10 years, when you go to retire, you can get a retirement benefit from that guy you were married to even 40 years ago if it was a 10-year marriage. So one thing I want to communicate to you, because I see a lot of young people here, if you're married and you're thinking about divorce and it isn't too many more years till 10, move out, separate, but don't get the legal divorce until 10 years have gone by. Because you can't remarry that guy and catch up. That doesn't count. It's got to be 10 consecutive years to the same guy. And because men make more money than women over their lifetimes, you might not think you need it, but you might need it when you're 65. You don't know what's going to happen in the future. So that's just a little thing to keep track of. And I really am finishing up. One problem is that although we have those spousal benefits, and that is the way we reward caregiving in the system now, not everyone is going to have access to those, especially African American and Hispanic women are having high rates of non-marriage and divorce. And if you have never had a 10-year marriage and you hit age 65, you won't have any males earning record that's nice and high, that's a little bit higher than yours, even among minority populations, to get a benefit from. So I would like to see us add to Social Security a caregiving benefit so that everybody would get a benefit for caregiving, whether or not they were married, and that would particularly help low-income women. So this is what we need to do. We need to account for the fact that more women are working, because that will, if we did that, there's a number of ways we could do that, and the benefits, that would help. We need to do caregiving. We need to increase benefits for vulnerable women who live alone. They are the poorest among the elderly. And we have to strengthen Social Security and actually increase benefits for women and not cut back on Social Security, just as economic insecurity is increasing in our society now. As you can see, more people are relying on it, so it's a really wrong time to cut those benefits. So here's the things you can do. You can like us on Facebook. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Always words of wisdom when you speak to us, Heidi. To keep it moving along, our next presenter is Dr. Alina Salgano. I always mess this up.
Salganica.
Thanks. I can say it in my head properly. Salganica, who is Vice President and Director of Women's Health Policy for the Kaiser Family Foundation, where she directs the foundation's work on health coverage and access to care for women, with an emphasis on challenges facing underserved populations. Alina was also an associate director for the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and has served on numerous federal, state, and nonprofit advisory committees, including the CDC's Select Task Force on Preconception Care and the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Women's Health and Preventive Services for Women, which is the IOM committee that recently came out with the recommendations for coverage of things like interpersonal violence and contraception without any copays. Salganica holds a PhD in health policy from the Johns Hopkins University School of Hygiene and Public Health. A native of Argentina, she is fluent in Spanish. Welcome, Dr. Alina.